This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And we're coming up on a very important anniversary, because it was 100 years ago when women were marching and making their interests known around the idea of voting in presidential elections, and for that matter, other elections. So we're going to talk about women's suffrage with a couple of people who have a pretty strong interest in it. Susan Wiefald is the co-chair of North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Committee. Thank you for joining us, Susan.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here today with you.
And also with her in our studio in Bismarck, Sarah Walker. Sarah writes for our Dakota Date Book, and she's going to be putting together a special series of date books around the idea of women's suffrage. Susan, North Dakota ratified the 19th Amendment on December 1st, 1919.
That's right, and we're getting ready to celebrate the 100th anniversary of that important event, and we're looking forward to two events happening in the state on that day, this next week, to celebrate that event.
Well, fill us in.
Well, the first one is going to be at the North Dakota Heritage Center, and it's called Celebrating 100 Years of Votes for Women, and it's a great program. It's for people of all ages. Starts at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's free and open to the public, and it goes until 4:30. It's part of it is the Sensational Sunday program, and at that we're having suffrage songs from 100 years ago led by singer and guitarist Chris Kitko from Bismarck. She'll be actually trying to encourage the audience to sing some songs, and if you'd like, I'll sing a suffrage song for you right now so you can get an idea.
Please do.
All right. This one is a suffrage song by Eliza Tonks, and it goes to the tune of Dixie, and it's one that suffragists would have sung in, around that time, 1919, 1914, around then. We want to vote without repression, for our faith, have free expression. Raise a shout, let it out, never doubt, we must win. And this shall be our battle song. Let's help this great old world along. Raise a shout, let her doubt, never doubt, we must win. And then it goes into the chorus. Oh, I wish I had the franchise. I do. Don't you? I pledge my vote. I pledge my hand to guard the freedom of the land. I do. Don't you? Let's help the cause along. I will. Won't you? Yes, help the world along.
So I'm imagining a street filled with women marching toward the Bismarck Capitol singing.
That's right. Exactly right. Or down any street in many of our towns across the state. And they were also giving speeches, and they would stand in the back of an old, we consider them an old Model T, but they were the newest model at that time, a 1914 car. There was a big push for women's suffrage in 1914 in North Dakota, all across the state. Thousands of women were involved with this push to get full voting rights for women in North Dakota and in that year. And a speech was written by Clara Darrow, who was the president of the North Dakota Votes for Women League at that time. And so we're going to have a dramatic reading on Sunday afternoon of her I Want to Vote speech. And many people are familiar with Deb Rogers, Brittany Bearshart, and Alice Masumba. And they're going to be our dramatic readers for that portion of that event.
Well, you also mentioned there are two events, and there's one that's going to be at Bonanzaville, isn't there?
There is, but I have to wait. I have one more important part to tell you about this program on Sunday afternoon.
Well, peel the onion.
Okay, and that is that our main speaker that day is Supreme Court Justice Lisa McIvers.
Ah.
And so she's going to be talking about what does ratification mean in our life today. So connecting it to current issues and things that people today can relate to.
Well, let's get to that Bonanzaville event. That's on this Sunday, December 1st as well.
And that's exactly right. And that is a paid event, and it's called the 100th Anniversary Suffrage Gala Fundraiser. And it's sponsored by the Cass County Historical Society, and it's going to be held at Bonanzaville, West Fargo, in the evening. And it actually is a cocktails, appetizer, and social starting at 5 p.m., a dinner at 7 p.m. with entertainment. And it is $20 for students and $40 for adults. And so you can go to their website for more information and to purchase tickets. I think it's wonderful that we have an event happening both in the eastern part of the state and in the middle of the state, so people can choose which one they want to go to. I wish I could go to both, but it's going to be a little hard for me to get on the highway at 4:30 in the afternoon from Bismarck and make it in time to get to Fargo for that gala event at 6 o'clock.
Sarah, you're going to be doing Dakota Date books around women's suffrage. So how are you going to frame that December 1st event?
My first date book is going to be on the 4th, which is the signing by the president of the Senate. And the Speaker of the House signed the bill to ratify on December 4th. So that's the first of the series. We'll be doing a date book for the 4th and the 5th, and then another one later in the month. And then we'll be doing about 2 per month, approximately. We'll be doing that through to next November, December, touching on different topics of suffrage around the state, but starting with the important, the big one, the ratification bill that passed through.
Well, these Dakota Date Book essays are, of course, literary enterprises, but they're also historically accurate. So how do you research something like this?
I often start with the Bismarck Tribune, especially for bills coming through, anything dealing with the legislature, because of the fact that they met in Bismarck. And so the newspapers often will cover the topics. And then I also have pulled the House and Senate journals. So I've been going through some of the notes of what was going on at that time in their special session, which was called for this purpose.
I would like to just add that we're finding that the newspapers are basically our only source of information about what was happening with these suffragists in North Dakota between the years, let's say, well, when we first got started in the 1870s up through 1920, because not very many women kept journals, and people didn't keep letters, and we're finding there were very few photographs. Although it's happened during the same time, a big push happened between 1912 and 1919, and it was the same time as the First World War. Although we have hundreds of photographs of things that people who left for the war, came back from the war, families of war members, scenes of the war, in with the suffrage battle, we have almost no photographs. And so if people have a photograph in their family album that they shows their grandma or even their grandpa as a suffragist in North Dakota, just contact Sarah or I. We would just love to know about that. Or if you have any letter that mentions women's suffrage in North Dakota, because our records are very slim.
You mentioned newspapers. The first iteration of history is usually the newspaper. My dad's newspaper used to be bound every year, just like every other newspaper in the state of Minnesota, and a copy of that bound volume of the year's newspapers was filed with the Minnesota Historical Society.
And we have the papers at the Historical Society here. I am the head of reference at the Historical Society here in North Dakota. I know Susan has been in doing quite a bit of research herself, and we've definitely been using those newspaper sources.
From a women's perspective, Susan and Sarah, why did it take so long, do you think, to win the right to vote?
Well, they had to convince the men.
Well, I understand that.
You know, I mean, and I think if it had been up to, let's say in 1914, there was a referendum. First, they had to go to the to get a constitutional change made in our North Dakota Constitution, they needed to go not one time but twice to the legislature to get that change approved and then put it on the ballot for the men to vote on. If you wanted to have the law change, you still had to go one time to the legislature, and then it was referred to the male voters. And so although we had
Catch 22.
Yes. And so although we had all of these women in the state, in 1914, they put out ads saying they had 40,000 women who had said that they were in favor of women's suffrage, it still was defeated in the polls. They were so disappointed. They put on a major campaign. Just think of the referendum campaigns that we have today. And they were doing newspaper ads. They were doing marches. They were having their songs. They were doing speeches in the street. they were doing railroad whistle car stop tours, you know, where you would pull into a station, give a speech from the back of the train, and off you go again to the next city. They were busy. They had out-of-state consultants. They had out-of-state money. They had in-state fundraising. They had in-state speakers. But it didn't work. But that doesn't mean it didn't gradually work, because although they lost in 1914, they went to the legislature in 1917 with a new idea. And their new idea was, well, let's just have the women vote for president and for municipal officers in North Dakota, because that's not mentioned in the Constitution, our state constitution. And that was easier for the male legislators to vote for, because the women still couldn't vote for them then, and they still couldn't vote for any state officials. So the legislature said, okay, so that was a step in the right direction in 1917 for North Dakota
women. I think it's also worth noting that not every woman wanted suffrage.
Yes.
So that is something that sometimes we forget about. Not every single woman wanted to have this right.
And why were some women opposed to it?
Oh, for various reasons. Some of them just thought that it should be up to the man.
They had confidence in the man.
Yeah, they had confidence in the men. Just various reasons. Some women just really were opposed to it.
Well, Susan, you mentioned that 1914 referendum failed because, of course, it was a bunch of men voting. So that created, I suspect, a bit of controversy around when 1919 rolls around, and it's not a referendum this time. It's the legislature ratifying it.
That's right? Exactly right. And so in the summer of 1919, Governor Fraser had to make a decision. Was he going to call a special session to ratify the 19th Amendment? And at first he said yes, then he said no, then he said yes again. So he did. He kind of waffled on that one a little bit that summer. But eventually he called a special session. He said this should be our first priority in this special session in November and late November 1919. And it was the very first it wasn't really a bill, but it was the first measure passed by the by our legislature. And we were state number 20 out of 36 that ratified the 19th Amendment. And, you know, there's a little confusion about the dates. Nationally, December 1st is considered the date that North Dakota ratified this. And that's because first the Senate ratified it and then our House ratified it on December 1st. As Sarah pointed out, they signed it on the 4th. Then Governor Fraser had a signing ceremony on December 5th with all the women present and legislators who were interested.
Right. Yeah, we were talking about that here. There are quite a few dates connected to this one important passing of this bill or this resolution.
Sarah Walker is a writer for the Dakota Date Book series, and she'll be doing special date books about women's suffrage in the coming year. Susan Wiefald is co-chair of the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Committee, and we'll be back with more of our discussion about women's suffrage in just a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck and dedicated to producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind projects in North and South Dakota.
Stephanie Rinka always said she never wanted to live on life support.
She would say, John, just shoot me. Don't ever let me get to that point. Just shoot me.
But what we want when we're healthy can be different from what we want when we're sick. Life, death, and our future selves, this week on Hidden Brain.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're talking now about women's suffrage. It's the centennial of the passage of the 19th Amendment, which was ratified by enough states finally by August of 1920. So we're starting that season of remembrance with Susan Wiefald, co-chair of North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Committee, and Sarah Walker, a writer for Dakota Date Book, which you hear here on Prairie Public. Susan, I noted when I was sort of going back and refreshing my memory about a lot of this stuff, that even though 1920 is the date of the ratification of the 20th Amendment, the final ratification, many states, especially in the South, held off on ratifying it until the 60s and 70s, and in the case of Mississippi, the last state, 1984. Now, that didn't mean that the law didn't apply to them, but it just meant that there was some sort of political pressure in that state not to go there.
You're exactly right. And when you look at maps where suffrage was approved before 1920, it basically moved from west. The western states approved full suffrage for women first. And then it moved through the Midwest, and even some of the eastern states were later in the process, and especially the southern states in the southeast. And one fact that we all know is that even though the 19th Amendment passed and all women were able to vote, not all women were able to vote because black women in each state, you mm-hmm. still had mm-hmm. states that were setting up their own requirements for voting. And so in the South, they targeted black men and women to try to keep them from being able to vote in different ways, just through voter registration and requirements that related to voting. Also, in Western states, states set up requirements and language related to voting for Native Americans. And so we had some of those same issues related to Native Americans in many states and also in North Dakota.
Well, let's talk about today. When you look around the state or the nation or the world, what sorts of disenfranchisement do you see?
Well, I think we still see some issues with disenfranchisement. 2 years ago now, in North Dakota, there was controversy about were some Native Americans being disenfranchised by a new requirement about addresses that they needed to produce in order to be able to vote on Election Day. And we had many people come into the state who helped to address that issue so that I think by the time we reached Election Day, the people who wanted to vote, most of them had a good an address that they could use. But it was a sticking point that many people raised. And so it just shows you it's the kind of issues that can come up today. And so part of our emphasis in talking about the fact that women, we're celebrating 100 years of votes for women, but we're also going to be addressing through this next year what are still some challenges that people have in voting.
Well, if you Google women's suffrage, it just rains information, Sarah. And if I go to the Wikipedia entry, for example, it's very extensive and it's clear that the history of it is just filled with important dates. It's not just the date that North Dakota ratified the amendment or the date that the 20th state did it or whatever. It's it goes back to statehood for North Dakota itself. It was considered in the Constitution, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It did not pass into the Constitution, though, so we did not enter with suffrage. Some states did have full or partial suffrage when they became states and entered the United States.
So when you're researching something like Dakota Date Book and you're looking for, you know, important touchstones in history to remind people of on that date in 2020, what are you looking for? How do you kind of weigh the evidence and make the decision?
It kind of is a combination of things. Sometimes I find something that fits to the date, and sometimes I find a date that fits to the information. We are able to pick a few different dates as we are writing for Date Book. We have a calendar and we just select them as we go. We also, for this series in particular, had a few dates that we knew that we wanted to highlight, which is why we have the first one starting on the 4th and 5th. We have a few other dates that we've selected based off of kind of that timeline of suffrage. So we will be having some dates picked based off of some of those dates that you might find when you Google suffrage or when you take a look at Wikipedia. Sometimes I find stories that are just really interesting that have no connection to a specific date. And I really love to write about those types of stories that are a one-off March 3rd, whenever, that might just be a really fascinating story of some woman trying to find her way in this struggle, or of some opinion that some man had about it. I just find those little tidbits fascinating. So it'll be a bit of a combination of those kinds of stories mixed with those specific dates.
Susan, as the case in many circumstances when you're talking about something that's a sort of a minority issue, and unfortunately women, even though they were at least half the population, were a de facto minority because they didn't have any vote, you need some people from the other side to come over. So how important were men to women's suffrage?
Oh, they were very important. In fact, I have a song in front of me.
All right.
Good. Now, just a minute, because I thought it was so interesting. It's the suffrage song to be sung to the tune of America. I'll sing it for you in a second. But it was the North Dakota Men for Women's Suffrage. This was their song, okay? And so I thought this was so interesting. It goes, "My country, 'tis for thee to make your women free. This is our plea. High have our hopes been raised in these enlightened days, that for her justice praised our land might be." Okay, so you see, they even had the men on board to have their own song to support the women with their suffrage goals. So it was, they knew, and there were a lot of, let me say this, there were a lot of enlightened men who were supporting women's suffrage and thought of them as suffragists themselves. And that's why we don't use the word anymore, suffragette, because suffragist, because it's, it doesn't mean you could be a man or a woman and be a suffragist.
Well, Susan, you're co-chair of the Women's Suffrage Centennial Committee. So when did your committee form, and how extensive is the event list coming up?
Well, we formed in January of this year, and we have women all over the state who are participating as part of our committee, and they have been so helpful. We have several projects we're working on for this next year. One of them is that we're working to secure five markers or historical markers for the state of North Dakota that relate to women's suffrage people, events, and places. And we've passed the first. We're going to be part of the National Votes for Women Trail. And this national group was looking for five markers in every state. And so we've gotten our applications in. We've passed the first round of application process. We're into the second. And those we hope to have in Pembina, Grand Forks, Fargo, Valley City, and Beach, North Dakota. So that's been an exciting project. Then we're also going to be applying to the North Dakota Humanities Council for some funds so that we can have some speakers go around the state and talk about suffrage topics and how they relate to people today. And then we are also planning a supplement of for the newspaper in August of 2020 that'll go out and contain articles about what was happening in North Dakota as far as women's suffrage, because that's a history that really hasn't been told that much. But to wind things up, I do want to point out that at the North Dakota Heritage Center event on Sunday, there will be a cartooning workshop with Jess Rockerman from 1 to 2 p.m. And I didn't mention that before, and that's because cartoons were very important in sharing the information that the sharing in a fun way points that the suffragists wanted to make. And then there will be also children's activities all that afternoon, including making Votes for Women banners and sashes, activity sheets, and a children's voting booth. So
all right.
Lots of activities.
Susan Wefald is co-chair of the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Committee. Sarah Walker is a writer for Dakota Date Book and will be voicing some Dakota Date Books about women's suffrage in a series through the next year. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, Marketing Hemp, and Ron Smith joins us to talk about holiday trees and flowers. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The National Weather Service says it's likely some parts of the plains will see snow on this Thanksgiving weekend, but the service says there are still a lot of unknowns. Forecaster Jeff Shield is with the National Weather Service in Bismarck.
The storm actually itself is way out in the Pacific Ocean still, so it has quite a ways to go. It still has to move onshore, and then it'll hang out towards the west coast for a little bit before it comes across the Rockies and ejects into the plains.
Shield says the questions are when and where it will eject into the plains.
What is looking greater and greater in certainty is that somewhere in the northern and central plains, there will be a storm developing that will impact travel this holiday weekend.
Shields says the Weather Service just wants people to be aware of this and to monitor the forecasts. Another wind farm is being built in northwest North Dakota. The Aurora Project is being built in Williams and Montreal counties. It will be a 299-megawatt facility. It's being built next to the 150-megawatt Lindahl Wind Farm. Both are owned by Enel Clean Energy. Enel Senior Project Manager Georg Becker-Burke was asked if the company has plans for more wind farms in that area.
At this point, there's no specific location that we can announce. But we are continuously scanning the area, and this area in the Bakken is a very good wind resource, so there might be potential for future projects.
Basin Electric Power Cooperative will buy 142 megawatts from the Aurora Farm. It will it already buys the output of the Lindahl facility. And a tradition for Thanksgiving, the governor pardons a turkey. The ceremony was held today at the state capitol in Bismarck as Governor Burgum pardoned Lily, a turkey raised by grower Dave Rude of Tolna.
By authority invested in me in the state of North Dakota, I hereby grant that Lily receives a relaxing turkey Thanksgiving back on the farm. And Lily, may you live long and healthy, and may you have lots of gobbling without being gobbled.
Rude says Lily is an organic turkey, meaning she's only fed special organic feed. Feed he has to import from Wisconsin. Rude says there are 9 turkey growers in North Dakota, and together they grow between 1 million and 1.2 million birds. He says he does have some concerns about the growing situation going forward.
We have an aging population of people, so the question is, do they have siblings or sons to take over or not? As of right now, everything is in status quo for the last few years, and hopefully it'll stay that way.
The North Dakota Turkey Growers Federation also donates a number of turkeys to charitable organizations around North Dakota for Thanksgiving dinners. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You can make a tax-advantaged contribution to Prairie Public from your IRA if you're age 70 and a half or older. To learn more, contact your financial advisor or call Troy Davis at 701-239-7510.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. CBD is showing up in lots of products. It's in everything from face cream to gummy bears. The compound is found in hemp, a cousin of the marijuana plant. And while health experts warn about CBD's side effects and call for more studies, some people believe it's a natural remedy for all kinds of complaints. Farmers have noticed the craze, but as NPR's Hannah Hegeman reports, there's no straight line between planting hemp and cashing in.
Your CBD store is a nationwide chain. This one in Alexandria, Virginia, has shelves stocked with tinctures, candies, lotions, and dog treats.
Okay, so that's coming out to $127.20.
Business is brisk. Customers are eager to see what CBD can do for them.
So I have really bad sinuses as well. Does that play any effect?
What if someone have a trouble with a diabetes?
With diabetes?
I heard the CBD helps from...
I can't say.
We're looking at the tops of the plant where it's all flowering here. This is what is the focus of the harvest.
Here in Sperryville, Virginia, Elizabeth Nelson shows me a small quarter-acre plot of CBD-bearing hemp. She got into farming 7 years ago, but this is her first time farming hemp.
We're all in this green rush. We want to grow for CBD. It's the most amazing, you know, hyped up nutraceutical on the market right now, and didn't realize how labor intensive it was.
Melson and her farmhand do everything themselves, cutting, picking, and curing. She dries the hemp in a converted garage, but doesn't have the space or equipment to process the plant into oil. Companies that can do that are overbooked. When Melson began, other hemp farmers who got in early encouraged her. They told her of the rewards.
From 100 plants, you can make $20,000 if you're selling to a CBD processor. Yeah, it's probably half that or less.
Their markets have bottomed out, and they don't have buyers for their product.
That's Jane Kaladinsky. She teaches economics at the University of Vermont. Kaladinsky says if you want to be a hemp farmer in a crowded marketplace, you have to be strategic.
It's the farmers who just came in and decided, oh, there's a CBD market. I'll plant hemp. who really didn't have a business plan, they're probably going to be hurt the most.
Glenn Rhodes probably won't get hurt. He's an eighth-generation Virginia farmer.
For now, it's a very, very high risk, high reward on the CBD side. It would be lower risk, lower reward on the grain and fiber side.
Right now, Rhodes is okay with the lower reward. He harvests hemp bark, seeds, and stalk. Those parts of the plant are versatile. They can be transformed into everything from fuel to building materials. The longtime farmer says he and his family also
raise turkeys. We grow crops like corn, soybeans, canola. We also raise beef cattle and have a dairy farm.
Hemp is just another crop the family hopes they can make some extra cash on. Rhodes planted 10 acres of it. He's hoping he can sell his harvest, 35 bales of fiber and 3,000 pounds of seed. Other farmers have taken notice.
I've actually gotten that phone call from a dairy farmer wondering if hemp could save his farm. And I just had to say, well, it's just too early. We don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the markets right now.
And without that market, first-time hemp farmers may be left empty-handed. Hannah Hageman, NPR News.
That story was from NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Next on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith with holiday tips.
Support for this program is provided by North Dakota Horizons, North Dakota's state magazine. Showcasing North Dakota's quality of place, its abundant resources, and people. Learn more on Facebook and at ndhorizons.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton in studio with Ashley Thornburg and retired NDSU Extension horticulturist Ron Smith. It's time to talk about plants around the holiday.
Ron, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And so you're going to be gifting us all with poinsettias and Christmas trees or, advice.
Advice.
There we go.
That's the easiest thing to give out.
Okay.
It's free.
What should we be doing this time of year? Is there much?
Well, try to be anticipatory of what is coming your way so you don't get stressed out. And one of the ways to keep yourself from getting stressed out is to consider having some houseplants that you're going to go ahead and take care of. And you can wait for friends or neighbors or family to give you houseplants, or you can go out and get them yourself. If you want to say, well, which one should I buy, Ron? Well, if you're the kind of person that gets wound up, like my wife and I are wound up because we're going to be going to see our grandchildren tomorrow. It's been over a month. We've seen them, and they're anxious to see us. We're anxious to see them. And so there's such a thing called lavender. You're all familiar with it. You can buy the oils of lavender, or you can buy a little lavender plant, and the plant gives off nice aromas, which is calming, relaxing, soothing. Relieves tension. Sounds good just to talk about it. If you don't want to have a lavender plant in your house because it requires care, you can buy the essential oils and just put a dab somewhere, anywhere you're going to be sitting and reading. It'll relax you some more. If you're reading something that's not going to get your blood pressure up, but if you want to relax and watch television, that's also a good thing to go ahead and have. There's lots of other plants you can go ahead and grow. The Boston fern is an excellent one. It humidifies the air. It also, yes, it does. I see that scowl on your face.
It was not a scowl. It was a what?
A what? It humidifies the air. It adds a
Why
lot of moisture.
Why would I scowl at that?
I don't know. I haven't learned to interpret your scowls from your, that's interesting, type of look. Anyway, it's got a lot of surface area there that exudes moisture vapor and helps to humidify the air in that particular region. It also does a good job of cleansing the air of toxins in the air. So if you have minor carbon monoxide leaks and benzene or formaldehyde in your furniture, those kinds of things, that can have they can help clean that out.
You said that's a Boston fern?
There's a Boston fern and a Dallas fern.
Okay.
The Boston fern is a little bit leafier, more abundant. It's like a... a grandmother or an aunt that's, you know, has wants to give you a big hug, and another grandmother or aunt that wants to just give you a squeeze around the shoulders and say you look great, you know, that type of thing. The Dallas fern is the tougher of the two as far as being tolerant of indoor conditions. And so you can try one or the other. They're both very similar in looks, and most people don't know the difference when they're looking at them. Two of my favorite plants I've got to talk about, the aloe vera, which is the wound plant, and then I'm sure Ashley knows what aloe is, right, Ashley?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I have. Yeah, aloe vera is one of the very few plants I can grow.
Yes, it is. It's very easy to grow, and it has that wonderful aloe syrup or whatever cream in its interior. So if you have rough, chapped hands from peeling potatoes this week or out shoveling the snow without gloves on or getting your hands too wet in the wintertime, come in, break off a branch of that little aloe, let the sap come out and rub it all over your hands, and it'll soften them up very nicely. If by chance you should burn yourself when you're handling all the hot stuff.
I totally did that this weekend.
Yeah. Bingo. Take that piece of the aloe out and then rub it on there. You'll get almost immediate effects, positive effects from that.
A lot of sun lotion has aloe vera in it.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Two finally. The spider plant, Chlorophytum, one of the easiest plants to grow. If you're one of these people that has benign neglect in your house.
You're looking at one.
Okay. This is a good plant to go. You say, when was the last time I watered it? Was it last week, last month?
A year ago.
A year? Well, maybe not quite a year. But they're very, very tolerant of benign neglect, and they're safe around animals. So if you have cats and dogs that like to nibble on your house plants, because cats and dogs like to do that for some odd reason, it's not going to make them sick. So that's a good, safe one to have. And one of the ones that I used to love to grow myself when I was fanatically interested in being a propagating horticulturist was the African violet. And that's been a long-forgotten plant, little St. Paulia. Easy to go ahead and grow. It's very easy to propagate. For example, if I had a pot full of African violet leaves, or a plant with a lot of African violet leaves, and you liked it, I'd say, here, take a leaf, propagate it. It'll grow ahead and grow new babies coming up there. You just take a leaf and cut it in half, stick it in the potting medium, and bingo, it'll grow. They do require – the African violet comes from a subcanopy in a rainforest, so it needs moist soil – but well-drained soil. It likes a lot of air around its root system. It also needs high indirect light, so a light like we have here in the studio, but not direct sunlight for any length of time, they will do very, very well. They don't need to be fertilized in the wintertime, but in the spring and the summer growing months, they will respond well to fertilization. So good watering. Don't put any water on the leaves. Water from below. Put your African violet in a little saucer and let the soil take it up through contact with the water. There, that should just about do it. Then there's always the Christmas cactus and the
poinsettias
and everything else that's out there that you can go ahead and be tempted by.
Well, let's talk about the really big one, the elephant in the corner of the room, the Christmas tree.
Ah, yes, the Christmas tree. Yeah. You know, it's people think, well, Ron Smith's a horticulturist, and he's going to say you only buy fresh cut live trees, you know. And I would have agreed with that years ago when we had kids and you wanted to have fun getting a live tree in and so on and so forth. It required a lot of work. It was messy. There's always a fire hazard and everything else along with that. But at the same time, when you get to be my age, you start looking at, you know, we have to go out and go pick this out from somebody that's been, you know, just has it set up. Everybody's going to be selling. I can't think of anyone other than the private homeowner that's not going to be selling Christmas trees. Supermarkets sell it. Churches sell it. Gas stations sell them.
The scouts.
Yeah, everywhere. You have fresh trees. The first question you're going to ask me, well, what variety of tree should I get if I'm going to get a live tree? The balsam fir is the best one. Followed very, very closely, and in some cases, Douglas fir, which is also a very beautiful tree. So the balsam fir and the Douglas fir, two very beautiful trees. They're usually grown very, very symmetrically, which we all love. And they have a good aroma to them. They have minimal needle drop. They stay that fresh look for a good long time. And what else? You buy one a little bit. If you want to get one that's going to fill up your room, you have a 7-foot ceiling. Buy one that's 8 feet tall. Cut the bottom foot off, and you have these swags of branches that you can go ahead and make and the swags, or your own wreaths if you want to. So there's that to go ahead and do. The tree should be, you're going to see them, if you haven't seen them already, all over the place in the retail outlets. They're going to be expensive, so brace yourself. Get over it. It's Christmas time, so it's only once a year. Is it destroying the environment? No, because what the Christmas tree farmer does is he replants or he continues to keep on growing this harvestable crop. It's a harvestable crop. It takes about 7 to 10 years in order for a Christmas tree plantation to go ahead and have something decent to go ahead and sell. So it's one of these situations where he'll have a section there where if you want a 15 to 20-foot tree, you go over to that section. If you want trees from 6 to 10 feet, you go over to this section. If you want a little tabletop tree, right over here is just right. Don't buy these little spruce tops. That always bothers me when I see those for sale. And because what they've done is they've taken and topped off spruce trees, and that disfigures the tree, and people set it on their tabletop, and the doggone spruce trees, the needles drop very, very easily. So if of all the trees out there, don't buy a spruce, please.
Okay.
Buy balsam fir, Douglas fir, or long needle pines.
How about getting it in the right kind of container and getting it ready to sustain itself for a few weeks in your home?
Yes. Yeah, when you buy your tree, keep it upright. Get it in a bucket of water. Make a fresh cut across the stump end there. Better at an angle because you have a higher surface area. And then get it upright. If you can wait until the last few days before Christmas to move it into the house, that'll be better because inside the house it's going to be warmer and drier and it's going to expire a lot quicker. If you can keep it in the garage or out back before bringing it in, it'll be good. It'll be all right. It'll do very well. And then bring it in. Make sure you have the right container, as you said, Doug, where it can hold water and expect it to drink like a lush, like a sailor on leave from his ship because it's going to suck up water. Don't say, I just put water in it last night, then it's gone. Yes, it's transpiring that water.
So another way to humidify the house.
Yes, it does.
Look at the bright side here.
That's right.
Are there things to notice when you are at a Christmas tree lot? Is there sort of an obvious sign of, not this tree?
Yeah. The best – and Christmas tree retailers have gotten wise to this if they are real Christmas tree retailers. They get their trees wrapped up in a bundle and then everything else. So they untie them and pull the branches down and they bang them down on to knock off as many – needles as possible. So when you come in and you take a look at it and say, bing, it didn't drop a lot of needles. That's good. Now, if you have a typical lot where, and I'm not going to name any names because I'm sure I would offend them, but if you don't go to a local garden center where they have the trees set up and they have already got them in the ideal position and they have them in some water, you're going to get a good tree. You're going to pay more for it, yes. But if you just want something to go ahead and fill that corner and put some ornaments on so the kids and the grandkids will be happy to see a tree there and get the presents under the tree, buy wherever you can. But don't buy trees laying down and take them home and then open them up. You want to get a tree that looks good all the way around, or it looks good three-quarters of the way around, because you can always stick the bad side into the corner, so which is what a lot of people did.
Yeah, well, what I do is I go down in my basement and take the tree out of the box and bring it upstairs.
Perfect. That's what we've done, too. Now, you might say, why is a horticulturist doing that? Because there's just Betsy and myself, just the two of us. And believe it or not, we've had that that ornamental tree for over 10 years, mm-hmm. and it still looks good. I mean, why should we ever get rid of it?
Mm-hmm.
We'll probably pass it on to our children or grandchildren.
Well, I'm always thinking, too, you know, after Christmas, the mm-hmm. berms are filled with
old
Christmas trees
right.
that are going to a landfill or someplace
Absolutely.
Where they will occupy space.
Mm-hmm.
They're renewable, but.
Yeah. It's just, it gets easier, and they look good, and they're becoming more attractive with each passing year. They're competitively priced, and you say, well, I paid $150 or $200 for that doggone artificial tree. Yes, but 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, with any kind of minimal care, it'll look halfway decent.
It's going to be fine.
The only thing you need to do is put an apron over it or a bag over it. They sell bags to cover those trees too. So
mm-hmm. it's pretty common for couples, you know, that first time they're having Christmas together, they want to go out
and cut
down their own tree.
mm-hmm.
They have no idea how hard that is, speaking completely from experience.
Would you like to pass that experience on to us?
Man, using an axe is hard. And Christmas trees are big.
Yes, they are. And they are a lot bigger than you think because you see them out in the open. And you bring it and say, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to cut 4 feet off the top of that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually the way it goes. And then you always find the Christmas tree that you and your hubby absolutely love. And it's a half a mile back into the plantation. And you're going to drag that thing out. And then you have to get it up on top of your car or in the back of your pickup truck bed and transport it home and get it upstairs into the living room. And then it's too tall, and you don't want to cut the top out, so you cut the bottom out, but you've got the – yeah. The other thing you need to watch out for is live trees many times will have some insects in them. And so when you bring it in and you start seeing, oh, why are we having bugs in here? What's going on? What was the last live thing you brought in?
Mm. Huh?
The Christmas tree.
Yeah, my aluminum bugs don't bother me at all.
Me either. In fact, they make good ornaments.
So you can spend a lot of time mm-hmm. finding the tree, getting the tree to your house, setting it up,
mm-hmm.
then happy holidays, then taking the tree down and getting it out of the house.
That's right.
There's a fair amount of time and labor
yes.
involved in that.
Yep.
But you might be doing other things.
Yes, absolutely. And as you get older, I'm sure, Doug,
noticed this.
You've
yes.
noticed that. You wouldn't have to spend time doing other things other than all of that. With the kids around or grandkids around, it's a lot of fun.
But keep it watered. Keep
yes,
it watered.
Absolutely.
Keep it watered.
Absolutely. Or else it becomes a fire hazard
right.
and a mess maker.
Right. Don't leave it up until March.
Why are you saying that?
I'm just saying. That seems real
You're
dangerous.
Just saying. Don't leave it up until March. Okay.
All right. Well, we check in with our horticulturist Ron Smith whenever we need to. And around the holidays, of course, there are questions about Christmas trees and other things. So thanks for coming in, Ron.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And happy Thanksgiving and season's greetings to you and everybody else out there.
And you can always email a question to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
Dakota Date Book is next.
I'm Dave Thompson. What goes into how we write? Well, the essential ingredients of writing are simplicity. As one book said one time, use the plain word instead of the fancy. Use the nickel word instead of the dollar word. And also make it sure that it's very understandable to everybody who's listening. Remember, we in radio are competing with other noise. When you're listening to the radio, you're probably in your car, you're listening to the tires against the roadway, you're listening to the wind whistling. So you have to cut through that, and the way to do that is simple and direct language. I also use a lot of actuality, meaning the newsmakers talking, because I want them to say it, not just me. Listen for regional news on Prairie Public, telling North Dakota's story.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Daybook for November 25th. On this date, in 1897, G.B. Norton was on trial for shooting and killing a man named Shelton. It seemed like the verdict was a foregone conclusion. People who knew Norton thought it would be impossible for any verdict except murder in self-defense. People waited anxiously for the result. One of the curious aspects of the incident was the name of the place where the crime occurred. Little Utah referred to an area about 6 miles south of Ludden, a small town south of Oaks in Dickey County. The area had a reputation for lawlessness, with grain, cattle, and horses mysteriously disappearing. The name Little Utah came from so many cases of divorce and exchange of wives, a reference to the polygamy then practiced by Mormons in Utah. The shooting involved just such an incident. The year prior to the shooting, Norton's wife left him and moved in with John Perry, a friend of Shelton, the man Norton was now accused of killing. Perry and Shelton harassed and threatened Norton. Norton's friends had warned him that Shelton might harm or even kill him. Shelton and Perry both made a point of going openly armed at all times. The day before the shooting, Shelton told the mortician in Ludden that he wanted a coffin and that in 24 hours either he or Norton would be lying in it. The next day, Shelton went to Norton's ranch to reclaim some of his sheep that he said strayed into Norton's flock. Angry words were exchanged, and Norton ended up shooting Shelton. Immediately afterward, Norton went to Oaks and turned himself in to the sheriff. He admitted that he had fired the shot that killed Shelton, but explained he had only done it in self-defense. 25 witnesses were called for the defense. They all attested to the fact that Shelton had threatened many times to kill Norton. The trial did not take long. On November 26th, the jury announced the verdict, not guilty. But that wasn't the end of the story. In January of 1898, Shelton's friend Perry wrote in a letter to the Oaks Weekly Republican that Norton was the aggressor. He claimed Norton had fired several shots at him. He also hinted that Norton was responsible for a fire that burned down his barn along with 5 tons of hay. After that, both men faded from the headlines. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, a number of key officials who helped run the 2016 elections won't be around for 2020.
Quite frankly, elections officials are exhausted.
What will it take to recruit new ones? Also, an actress takes center stage in a star-studded new murder mystery.
Were you intimidated at all?
Oh, yes.
I was terrified.
Listen for all kinds of stories on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, the State Bank of North Dakota has been around for 100 years, and now the idea seems to be catching on in other states. We'll discuss publicly owned banks with Walt McCree, Senior Advisor and President Emeritus of the Public Banking Institute. Also on our show tomorrow, Tom Eason will share a Plainsfolk essay. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.